hear some things about the F1 now.
Yeah. Joe, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I don't know if I can top out all that after Paul. as Bob just indicated there, the F program started about 1958. And the first engine, the first R&D engine, was completed and tested in May of 1961. Now, the first engine, even though we were supposed to be developing a 1500K thrust engine, the first couple of engines we built and tested were only operated at 1 million pounds of thrust. This primarily because some of the design concepts and structures and what have you that we had available at the time were not capable of the higher power levels. And to get a jump on the test activity, rather than try to develop the full-size thrust chamber, we went in with a short thrust chamber that only had an expansion ratio of 3:1. Mm-hmm. The production configuration chamber, as you may know, has a expansion ratio to 10:1, cooled with the RP fuel, with a nozzle extension that expands the ratio out to 16:1. Mm-hmm. So then we proceeded for the first two engines with short thrust chambers like that and operating at the low thrust level. And the third R&D engine we had is when we had the first 10:1 thrust chamber expansion ratio. But it still operated at the 1 million pound thrust level. Then the next engine is when we came in with operating at the 1500K and operated there ever since.
This is the fourth R&D engine?
Yes. Uh-huh. Serial number wise, we skipped engine 3. So if you relate back to the movie,
Engine 5
serial number is the one that we started operating at that power level. And once we started operating at this power level and started expanding our development program to evaluate all the effects of operating an engine like this, one of the first major problems that we encountered was combustion instability in the main chamber. And it was considered to be of such a magnitude relative to state-of-the-art on how to handle such a problem that a separate organization was created within Rocketdyne to undertake and develop a dynamically stable injector. And our friend Mr. Fontaine here was one of the charter members of that committee to develop a dynamically stable injector for the F1.
Okay, the engine instability was directly related to the injector problem.
Yes. The engine instability problem is really a combustion instability problem. And it is one in which a disturbance in the chamber, which can be caused by many things, we refer to those as triggers, or what starts the instability, would persist into uncontrolled oscillations. And these are not oscillations of a very simple linear nature, like it's a simple solution to a linear differential equation, but rather they're very aperiodic and violent in magnitude. And the detrimental effects of these are twofold. Number one, as these pressure oscillations increase, of course, there's accelerations imparted, and there are structural failures that take place. And not only within the combustion chamber, but it imparts accelerations to the entire engine system. And so we've had failures where we shook a main fuel valve, for example, and cracked the casing and then caused it to rupture. Or we could have failed some of our critical hydraulic control lines or other parts of the engine get affected, such that you just cannot physically beef up an engine enough to withstand these uncontrolled oscillations. You've got to solve the problem. The second effect, I might add, would be the heat transfer effect. You know, much of the cooling in the rocket engine is done by film cooling. For example, the outer walls of the thrust chamber have more fuel in the outer rings than they have in the inner rings in order to have a layer of fuel floating down the side walls of the chamber. In these uncontrolled pressure oscillations, there are, of course, the velocities of the fluid go along with the oscillations, and you kind of wipe the cooling fluid off the walls. Well, you expose a bare metal piece to a 5,000, 6,000 degree temperature, and we burn out the chamber. And there are many documents throughout the history of all rocket programs of the effects of instability, and they're pretty violent. Aerojet one time had an instability problem in which they had literally just cut the entire chamber off right at the injector end, and the chamber went down into the flame bucket. Just by the heat transfer effect, just wiped it off and increased the heat so much they melted the metal and the chamber went into the flame bucket. So it is a significant problem, there's no question about it. The problem with the F1 was that our largest injector in diameter was 21 inches prior to going into the F1. That was the injector used on the Atlas and Thor programs, also the H1. The F1 injector is 39 inches, or we refer to 39 point something. It's actually 40 inches in diameter. So it was a significant difference. Okay, now the difference in size has another effect to it also, and that is that the resonant frequency of the thrust chamber is inversely proportional to the size of the thrust chamber. So the larger the chamber, the lower the frequency. The lower the frequency, it's typical to assume that it's more easy to excite and less easy to damp or to decay. And very frankly, we had a hell of a problem on the F1. And it wasn't a case where we went unstable every time. We could run stably, but sometimes we'd be unstable, and when we were unstable, it was very difficult to shut the engine down in time in order to preclude any failure of any components. Now, by the way, I might add here that Rocketdyne pioneered the rough combustion cutoff system that was implemented. It was implemented actually before the F1 program, but we made use of it on the F1. And that's where we sense the accelerations in the thrust chamber. And if they exceeded a certain magnitude for a certain time period, we initiated automatic shutdown. And the time period we had decided upon was 100 milliseconds. So just a 1/10 of a second of oscillations above a certain prescribed magnitude would affect automatic engine shutdown.
That was for ground test only.
For ground test only. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Then what, then the engine takes something like about a second in order to shut down, maybe 700 milliseconds. And just in that 800 milliseconds total of instability, you could completely eliminate a thrust chamber or do such extensive damage to the injector, we'd have to scrap it. We've also had cases I mentioned where we ruined main fuel valves, failed hydraulic lines, and it's a pretty catastrophic type of problem. And so that had to be solved, and I guess now we'll go into the technology background a little bit because I think it's very significant. We had similar problems to that. Matter of fact, most rocket engine systems have had combustion stability problems at one time or other during its development. And we had a problem on the Atlas thrust chamber that way, which, by the way, was just as catastrophic. It would wipe out a thrust chamber or damage an injector. And we spent many years in looking into what causes the instability, what causes the trigger. And we finally concluded in the F1, it was kind of the first program that did that, that said there are so many potential triggers. For example, gas in the system might cause an interruption of the flow pattern. That may be the trigger. Hot or heated liquid oxygen may act differently than cold liquid oxygen. Maybe that causes the problem. Maybe there are the way the propellant flow accumulates on a thrust chamber wall may be a problem. And finally, in F1, what we decided is it is impossible to protect against all of these self-triggers. And that the only way we'd ever get out of the problem in F1 was that we must come up with an injector which we referred to as being dynamically stable. And it was the first contract of which I'm aware that the government ever contracted with any contractor to develop an engine that, when subjected to a disturbance, it would self-damp. Okay, we could withstand this instability. Not withstand it, but it would get the disturbance, would go unstable, and would come back to normal operation in the prescribed time period without affecting the engine hardware or affecting a mission. And that's the task we set out to do in the F1 combustion stability program. As Joe mentioned, the program became of such a magnitude that Rocketdyne formulated a separate organization, which was called Project FIRST, by the way, which meant it was the first priority program in Rocketdyne, a separate organization reporting directly to the chief engineer to do nothing but solve the combustion stability problem on F1. And we did draw on some technology. The first thing we drew on was the Atlas program developed what was referred to as a baffled injector. And what it did was, instead of letting this instability persist in a 21-inch diameter compartment, it broke up the face of the injector into smaller compartments. And the Atlas uses a center hub with 6 radial vanes. So if here was the injector, we put a hub in like this and 6 radial vanes, therefore breaking this into compartments, okay? Now the first thing that does for you is it increases the resonant frequency. If you can assure that you do not have communication from one compartment to the next, then I can look at this as its own separate little thrust chamber, and the theoretical frequency at which it will go unstable will be much higher than the other one, okay? And that gives you a couple of advantages. So the F1 decided that we would look at the baffled injector approach. We also did look at, as you saw in that film, various other approaches of different kind of injection systems. And in formulating this committee, we formulated with a group of experts within Rocketdyne. I hesitate to use the word experts, because somebody asked you what a definition of an expert is, but let's say people pretty familiar with the fluid system and what their contribution might be, people involved in chemical research that knew the reaction of the propellants, thrust chamber dynamics, aerothermodynamics, and fields like that. But we decided not to limit ourselves to just the Rocketdyne expertise, but to go out and hire consultants. And NASA formed what was called an ad hoc committee, which was comprised of people from universities and other industries and Rocketdyne to mount a major task and solve this combustion stability problem. Some of the key contributors there were Dr. Luigi Croco from Princeton, who was a renowned individual in the field of combustion instability, and he formulated some of the original work in combustion. Dr. Preem from NASA Lewis Research Center was a member of the team. Rocketdyne had its members who were the assistants to the chief engineer. We did have some expertise from the Rocket Propulsion Laboratory at Edwards Field Laboratory, or Edwards Air Force Base. That was Dick Weiss, who was a combustion expert in the Air Force, and plus some members from the Marshall Space Flight Center. Jerry Thompson was the primary individual there who contributed. In addition to those people, Rocketdyne hired a number of consultants that came in that represented many, many fields. For example, we had Starkman from the University of California, who had worked with the automobile engine and the knocking and what the lead additives did to see if we maybe some additive approach to the fuel would make the combustion system more stable. We had people from Lewis Research Labs involved in feed system dynamics, questioning what is the effect of the feed system perturbation on the combustion instability. We could go on. There's numerous industries, and we actually consulted with people from Aerojet. I don't think we had any Pratt & Whitney people that I can recall. Talked to people at Purdue University, Ohio State University, Osborne, Zucro, and people like that who are pretty renowned in the field of combustion instability, and kind of try to garner from them all the information they had and apply it to our operation. As I say, plus drawing on the information we had from the Atlas program, the Redstone program at Rocketdyne, the Thor, the Jupiter. And we evolved over a period of time. The committee was formed in 1962, actually October of 1962. It was essentially disbanded in late 1966. However, by mid-1964, we had achieved some of our major goals. And as I say, the first goal was to produce an injector that when a self-trigger took place, whether it be artificially induced or normally incurred, that the injector would respond and damp to this instability. And the first question came up, in what time do you want it to damp? Well, as I mentioned to you, we had our rough combustion monitor system set at 100 milliseconds. So it sounded like a pretty good idea. We'll set it for 100 milliseconds. And if we can damp before the RCC system, as we call it, cut the engine off, we would consider that achievement. And so for the flight rating test engine, we developed that to be a criteria. The engine must demonstrate that it can withstand or damp the instability within 100 milliseconds. And I guess in about 1964, we demonstrated in a series of three tests, that lo and behold, the injector developed could do that. At 100 milliseconds damping, you can shake a few brackets and lines loose. And so what we decided to do was to kind of improve on that, and in the qualification program, reduce that requirement to 45 milliseconds. And that took further injector modifications to provide higher reliability or more assurance. And in 1966, we successfully completed a series of 6 bomb tests where we purposely induced the disturbance. By the way, there was a specification on what magnitude of disturbance you had to induce, and proved that on 6 successive tests on 3 different injector units, no, 6 different injector units, that we could damp the instability in less than 45 milliseconds. So it was the first contract that I know of in which this was a requirement. It was surely a major undertaking. I hesitate to talk about dollar figures. We're not really too proud of the amount of money it takes to solve a problem. But this one, I think, was something like approaching $30 million was spent in the solution to this problem. That sounds like a lot of money, but in terms of the catastrophic effects of an instability, should we ever experience one in flight, of course, the entire mission would be in complete jeopardy. Secondly, it's important that if we had taken the opposite approach and just try to protect against these self-triggers, we would have had to develop one heck of a lot more hardware, because we would have to have been prepared to scrap out a number of injectors when instability took place. For example, on the Atlas program, the reliability requirement was something like 95%. So you could withstand an instability, let's say 1 out of 100 tests. On the F1, with the reliability requirement being 99% for the entire engine, okay, that would require maybe 1 instability in 1,000 tests, because you have the leaving room for failures in other areas like turbopumps or gas generators, etc. So it was obviously a major undertaking, and fortunately, after a few years of devoted effort on a number of people's part, it was concluded successfully. A side note to this, by the way, is one of the guys highly responsible for the success of that program was Dr. Dan Cloutie, who worked here at Rocketdyne. And the NASA has decided to honor his work in the development of combustion instability by naming a, well, first of all, giving his widow, he died of a heart attack during the conduct of that program. They gave his widow the Public Service Award in his honor. And just read in the paper here a week ago, they've named a moon crater after Cloutie. So it was a major accomplishment, and thank God they recognized some of the people that contributed to that. We could go on talking in the combustion stability area, or at least I could, because I was a part of it for 4 years, for days. I'm not sure exactly how deep you want to go. It did draw, as I say, from all sorts of industries, from all the national locations. Anybody who had anything to say about it, we Rocketdyne participated in numerous national meetings, things like the International Combustion Institute, the Interagency Chemical Rocket Propulsion Working Group meeting, and trying to draw on the experience of all other people, either in industry or in government or at universities, and found out what their experience was and attempted to apply it to the F1 stability problem.
I think what we want to do is kind of identify some of the, or several of the major technological things. So I wonder now, what other ones besides the instability problem
okay.
developed, or what, and how would we?
Okay. Well, I think we can go on from there, and Joe has a number of other ones.
Okay. From there, that got us into a point where we could successfully go through our flight rating test series in 1964. And basically, and at that point is where we evolved the initial configuration production engines that we were delivering at that time. And these were the engines that were used. This configuration engine was used for the first flights of the Sat-5 vehicle. Then in 1966, we continued the development and brought it to the qualification phase. These earlier engines, physical configuration-wise, some of the notable features, this is the little model of the F1 over here. Anyway, I can bring it over here on the table. Configuration engines delivering in production. The high pressure ducting between the turbo pump and the thrust chamber were flexible ducts. They had bellows assemblies in them, and were made of Inconel steel. We found that there were some problems having a high pressure ducting system with flexible joints. They were difficult to fabricate and quite expensive. So on the qualification configuration, even before we got the qualification configuration engine, the engines used for the second flight of the Sat-5, we went to the current configuration here, which are ducts formed out of aluminum tubing. And this was kind of a major breakthrough in that we were connecting the turbopump assembly, which is hinged about its mounting point here, to the thrust chamber assembly without any flexible joints in the feed system. And basically the flexibility came out of the fact of the configuration of the fuel duct with these large radius elbows and the rigid ducting that can actually flex even though it's rigid tubing. And these ducts are in the neighborhood of like 4 inches in diameter on the fuel side and about 6 inches in diameter on the lock side. So it's pretty good sized ducting to take that kind of loading. That approach had been used in some large steam plants and things of that nature, though. Sometimes you see some petroleum ducting and steam pipes with large loops in them. So basically that concept had been demonstrated previously but never used or employed on a rocket engine. That significantly reduced the complexity and cost of fabricating the ducting.
By the way, as a result of that, we did submit a sizable credit proposal to NASA on the production contract. When we switched from the flexible ducting to the solid ducting, there was a credit given to the contract. I forget the number, but it was over $1 million, I know, was saved from the program by making this conversion.
In the area of the nozzle extension on the thrust chamber, the concept had never been used on a
rocket engine previously in production to
have a nozzle extension that was cooled by the turbine exhaust gas. So basically what we do is take the turbine exhaust gas, distribute it in a manifold that runs all the way around the thrust chamber at the 10-to-1 expansion ratio region, which is as far as the fuel coolant in the nozzle goes. Then the exhaust gas is ejected through a ring all around the exit into a double wall nozzle extension. And the internal surface of the nozzle extension is made up of several rows of shingles, overlapping shingles, and the exhaust gas is ejected through those shingle gaps to cool the nozzle.
And at the same time, you get regenerative cooling in this
down
area.
Down to this point,
yeah,
with the fuel. Mm-hmm. Now, as Paul indicated on the J2, it's a pass and a half chamber. They bring their fuel in halfway down the nozzle, bring it down and back up. In the case of the F, it's more the conventional pattern where all the fuel comes into a manifold up here at the top of the thrust chamber, runs down alternate tubes to the exit, turned around and comes back up adjacent tubes. At the 3-to-1 expansion ratio area, being we are expanding the nozzle to such a large size, we do splice together the tubes at this point, and for every one tube coming down to this point, there are two tubes spliced into that joint. And we call it the 2-to-1 splice joint. Mm-hmm. So from this point down, every two tubes, adjacent two tubes, are down tubes, and then adjacent two tubes or up tubes.
So you do that because if you're expanding to 10-to-1, you can expect that the tube at this location is one diameter, okay, or one cross section. And if you continued one tube down to the 10-to-1, it gets to be a pretty large tube, and you got the big problem of an expanding tapered tube. So instead of doing that, what we do is when before we get that big split, we split it into two, mm-hmm, and then come down and don't get too large.
Now the tubes themselves are already tapered in cross-section to help compensate for the fact that it is expanding. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you look at the tube before it's formed into the contour of the thrust chamber, it's not a constant cross-section. It does taper down narrower at the throat than at the two ends.
Might just comment on that extension skirt, as we refer to it. Now that was a significant development program. As Joe said, it had never been used before in a rocket engine program. Since it was designed for a single-use operation, the F1 engine is, consideration was given to having an ablative-type skirt, mm-hmm, okay? The problem became one of very high cost for ablatives on a per-unit basis, mm-hmm, plus the fact that the planned development program was going to have numerous tests conducted, and since you can only use ablative once or maybe twice at the most, we'd have to build many, many R&D units. By essentially having a reusable skirt, we saved an awful lot of development money because you put one on and you could run it for the life of the engine. Mm-hmm. But consideration was given and extensive studies were done on ablative nozzle extensions.
I guess that's what's amazing to me, really. I always, you know, saw these engines go and I thought, geez, you know, one engine, one shot, that's the whole business. And I think it's quite remarkable you get that much work out of one.
Yeah.
Now, actually, I guess maybe that's a point that we always tend to overlook because it's just part of it. But
yeah,
even though the engine is designed for a single shot flight mission,
yeah,
our requirement in developing the engine is to show that in the case of the F and demonstrated in QualLife that it's good for 20 starts, 2,250 seconds life, mm-hmm, without any significant degradation in either performance or hardware integrity.
Mm-hmm. As a side note, I might add, is that in the formulation of the reusable shuttle program, some consideration has been given to the use of an F1, which it can be fired again after some servicing operations. Mm-hmm. So that even though it's designed primarily for single shot use, it is reusable, but it does take some servicing in between. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's very important in the development cost of an engine. So it makes these small ablative chambers development programs pretty expensive. If you have to run 100 development tests, you need 100 chambers. If we had to run 100 development tests, we might build 3 or 4 engine systems as a, mm-hmm, possibility, or 5. Mm-hmm. And so you save a lot of development costs that way.
Routinely in the R&D test program, we conduct in the neighborhood of 50-60 tests in between 5 and 6,000 seconds on an engine.
Hmm.
On the same hardware.
On the same engine.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it, that does give you a lot of confidence also that when you're going to launch this thing, that the hardware is going to hold up, because it's been demonstrated over and over and over again,
mm-hmm.
that it's good for much longer life than what's required to complete the flight mission.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now we've talked about the instability problem. We've talked about the difference here going to the hard instead of the flex lines. The unusual factor of this skirt extension here. What other things you got?
Okay, the turbo pump assembly is a little different than most rocket engines up to this point have been. And that one thing, we're developing in the neighborhood of 60,000 horsepower in a turbine, which, needless to say, is quite a bit of power with two-stage turbine of flight weight. One of the things I guess you have to always remember too is for the flow rates and power levels and things of that nature that we're talking about, that to keep the weight down into a reasonable size was a pretty good challenge on this thing too. So even though we used the basic concepts that had been developed previously, even in the neighborhood of materials, for instance, like the turbine manifold assembly is made of Rene 41 material, which is a